sending a similar message to our brain to relax that we would experience if we were genuinely outdoors. This imagery connects us to nature and grounds us in a lovely, calming way that facilitates an even deeper experience of the theta state. Next steps. Excellent. You have completed your self-hypnosis process for increasing self-worth. Now go ahead and visit www.closeyoureyesgetfree.com to access this chapter's longer hypnosis recording. Pop in your headphones, sit back, relax, and close your eyes, get free. After you listen to the recording, please let me know how it went using the hashtag closeyoureyesgetfree on Instagram or Twitter. Message me at GraceSmithTV, your starting and ending numbers on the stress scale. By using the hashtag, you'll get to see how other readers are improving right alongside you. Plus, I will have an opportunity to personally cheer you on. Move on to chapter 3 and continue to look out for all of the wonderful benefits you're already starting to receive as a result of learning the power of hypnosis. Chapter 3, The History of Hypnosis. The year is 1863. George is a medical student and is extremely proud of his chosen profession. He believes the advancements he is experiencing during his age, during his prime, will make history. Every day, George feels blessed to sit inside the auditorium with his contemporaries. He hears the best minds speak and watches them perform procedures, and he occasionally asks questions as the procedures are taking place. There's nothing quite like it. While the seats may be worn, stiff, and uncomfortable, George hardly notices. The room itself is quite cold. George wears a coat and gloves with the fingertips cut off so that he can write as quickly as possible. He leans in as if the closer he can get, the more details he will remember. Every day he learns more about the fascinating composite of parts that is the human body. He learns about the electric nature of the brain. He sees how far humanity has come in our understanding, and he discovers how much we still don't know. Today, though, what George saw was truly astounding. A guest lecturer was asked to demonstrate the power of the mind. They joked about it, George and his friend Ryan, while finishing off their cigarettes on the oval before entering class. Quote, the power of the mind, end quote, seemed a redundant phrase to them, even laughable. The mind itself is only power. It's simply unlimited potential. Still, for all of their jokes, they'd never miss a class. The lecturer began by explaining that his patient was allergic to the anesthesia that had become popular in recent years. The patient was in need of surgery to remove a tumor. George and his classmates braced themselves for what would ensue. They had all seen a number of surgeries without anesthesia, as it was not always easy to come by. The screams were not easily forgotten. Then the most peculiar thing began to happen. The lecturer began to speak to the patient in a slow, monotone voice, quite different from that of his natural speaking cadence. He began telling the patient to relax deeply all parts of the body. He then told the patient that his eyes were tired and they would not open, no matter how hard he tried. George watched as the patient attempted to open his eyes. He saw the patient try his damnedest as his eyebrows rose, creating visible creases, yet the eyes remained closed. There was a whisper running through the auditorium. The lecturer continued. He lifted the patient's arm, and as he let it go, he said, "Even deeper now." The arm dropped down with a heavy thump into the patient's lap, like a wet towel. It almost appeared as if the patient were in a very deep sleep, but the lecturer asked him to share with us how he was feeling, and he spoke. The patient said, "Calm, light." The lecturer said, "Very good. You're doing very well." He then told the patient that there was a dial inside his body, specifically where the surgery would take place. He gently pressed that point on the body and told the patient that he could turn the dial from 10, which would be 100% full sensation, all the way down to zero, where he would feel nothing. The lecturer then moved the patient's hand over to a small pad of paper on the table beside the hospital bed. He placed a pen in the patient's hand and asked him to write his level of sensation. The lecturer counted from 10 to 0 slowly, pressing the same spot, as the patient wrote each number on the pad until he reached that level of sensation. When he reached the level of 0, the lecturer asked the patient whether he could feel the pressure. He wrote 0 again. Then George and his classmates all rose to their feet and cheered. The patient did not move a muscle, despite our noise. The lecturer made an incision, and the patient did not flinch. When asked his level of sensation, he wrote 1. The entire surgery took place without anesthesia. The tumor was removed, and the patient continued to breathe peacefully. The highest number the patient ever wrote was a 3, but on the whole, he mostly maintained a level of 0 to 1. George was astonished. After the stitches were sewn, the patient was then brought back to total awareness. The lecturer counted from 0 up to 10, and the patient opened his eyes, and of all things, he smiled. He was asked to explain what the procedure had been like for him. He said he could feel the discomfort at the point of incision at about a level 5, but during the surgery itself, it never reached above a 3. He said the entire time that he knew he was in the room being watched by all of the students, but that it just didn't seem to matter much. Instead, he imagined he was on the beach, as the lecturer had told him to do. He somehow was both on the beach with his feet in the ocean, while also being watched by a room full of students. He was deeply relaxed and felt relatively peaceful at all times. After resounding cheers, congratulations, and thanks, the patient was wheeled into a recovery room. The lecturer remained behind to answer questions. George then learned he was a physician who had been introduced to the power of the mind, as he calls it, while treating soldiers on the front line. He was head of surgery at an outfit that ran out of anesthetic supply for more than 2 weeks. It was rumored that a local man in a nearby village was trained in the art of the mind, and that he could train people to decrease pain levels in their own body. Our surgeon studied with this man, and together, they used this process in hundreds of surgeries moving forward. In fact, the recovery rates of the men were found to be faster than with the use of anesthesia. As a result, even once his anesthesia supplies had been refilled, the surgeon opted to continue with this procedure over the others. He urged George and his classmates to study the mechanisms of deep relaxation, focused concentration, and the power of suggestion. He told them they needed to understand that the pain centers of our clients are located in their minds. In fact, our entire perception of reality is found within the mind, and by harnessing these centers, we can accomplish what was never thought possible. Needless to say, George was thrilled that he and his contemporaries witnessed this powerful tool, hypnosis, the surgeon called it, and that all medicine would now and forever be informed by the power of the mind. The evolution of hypnotherapy. This story is loosely based on what I imagine it must have been like for hypnosis pioneer James Braid as he watched the presentation by Charles LaFontaine at the Manchester Athenaeum on Saturday, November 13, 1841. Which pivoted his career-focused hypnosis for the rest of his life. Braid and many of his contemporaries believed that hypnosis would become a cornerstone of medicine during their lifetime. Sadly, and for many of the reasons we will discuss in this chapter, that clearly was not the case. Even though it has been 175 years since James Braid sat in that lecture hall, hypnosis is still not a cornerstone of medicine, nor is it yet a mainstream standalone healing practice. However, during just the years that I have been a hypnotherapist, I have noticed that the use of hypnotherapy has begun to expand rapidly. More and more physicians and dentists are using hypnosis in their offices. The popular BBC documentary Science of Hypnosis, filmed a live teeth extraction and implant placement with no anesthetic, just hypnosis. And Oncology Nurse Advisor reports the increasing use of hypnosis in cancer treatment. Fortune 500 companies are bringing in hypno-coaches for their top executives, and reality TV shows are producing episodes where lead talent overcome adversity with the use of hypnosis. While hypnotherapy is finally experiencing the boom its efficacy should have always warranted, this is by no means a new tool, nor is it the first time hypnosis experienced popularity. My hope is that by my sharing with you the history and efficacy of hypnosis through the ages, you will be even more inspired to continue using hypnosis in your daily life. The textbook Hypnosis and Communication in Dental Practice provides a wonderful summary of the history of hypnosis and tells us that this tool actually dates back to circa 1550 BC in the Egyptian Abers Papyrus, an ancient medical text, which tells us that powerful suggestions were read to deeply relax patients inside the temples of sleep. Who wouldn't want a day pass to the temples of sleep? While they sound absolutely dreamy, this is not exactly where locals went to take a nap, but instead where they would relax deeply and receive suggestions that were considered to be medicinal. Sound familiar? During the same time in history, the Romans also began building temples for similar sleep rituals. My ancestors, the Celtic Druids, who inhabited what are now Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and Great Britain, had their own druidic healing rituals specifically for their version of sleep temples. So, I guess this talking to people with their eyes closed thing runs in the family. We now know that sleep temples existed in multiple locations throughout the world at the same time in history, and that the results their patrons experienced were so powerful that their healing impact is known even today. So, what happened? As Christianity started to spread throughout Europe, sleep temples, along with a multitude of other natural healing techniques, quickly became regarded as witchcraft and were outlawed. The Handbook of Contemporary Clinical Hypnosis explains what happened in the following way. Quote, "With the rise of Christianity, healing was seen as a miracle or a gift from God, trance states as evil and practiced by witches, and illness and suffering as part of humankind's payment for being born with original sin, just punishment for wrongdoing." In medieval times in the Western world, there was a resurgence of the belief that mental illness was linked with demonic possession, and the afflicted would be required to undergo ritual exorcism or tortured to expel the demons involved, end quote. In short, the church unleashed a smear campaign ensuring that there would only be one source of miraculous healing in town. Sadly, this was the start of a centuries-long public relations battle that hypnotherapy historically lost, at least until recent history. And if I have anything to say about it, the truth about hypnosis will once and for all replace the lies conjured up during these manipulative times. For hundreds of years, the techniques used in ancient sleep temples were unknown to the general public, but a resurgence began in the 1700s. Franz Anton Mesmer, born 1734, died 1815, from whom the word mesmerize was derived, began using tools similar to what were described in the ancient sleep temples to great effect. However, as time went on, his practices expanded to include bizarre dramatics, such as wearing a black cloak during his presentations and tying up his clients with ropes. The church eventually declared that mesmerism was also part of the occult. However, as we've discussed, hypnosis is a natural state that we enter into and out of all day long. It doesn't require a swinging watch, a fancy cloak, or a rope for it to work. The term hypnosis wasn't coined until 1843 by Scottish physician James Braid. Unfortunately, from the very beginning, the word has been a misnomer and has added to the misunderstanding of this tool. Hypnos was a god in Greek mythology. He was the physical personification of sleep. So from the very beginning, the deeply relaxed and peaceful state reached through hypnosis was confused with actual sleep. Hypnosis, the first anesthesia. Anesthesia was first used during surgery in 1846. Before the advent of anesthesia, it was a common practice in the medical field to use hypnosis during surgical and dental procedures throughout Europe. John Elliotson, born 1791, died 1868, an English professor of medicine, claimed to have performed over 400 successful operations on patients with the use of hypnosis. Amputations under hypnosis were common during World War I from 1914 to 1918, as well as many dental extractions and surgeries, including the removal of tumors. Hypnosis was also used to treat soldiers suffering from shell shock resulting from that war. Unfortunately, this was not so that they could heal and return to a normal life, but so that they could return quickly to the battlefield. While the motive may not have been the most admirable, it's exciting to know that hypnosis was being used in the aid of PTSD patients as early as World War I. James Braid, who inspired our opening story, published a book in 1843 called Neuropnology or the Rationale of Nervous Sleep, which cemented the word hypnosis in the medical field. He had been performing successful surgeries and dental extractions for years with hypnosis as his sole form of anesthesia. He was a pioneer who was one of the first doctors to recognize that hypnosis was brought about by focus of attention and heightened suggestibility. This was the beginning of modern-day hypnotherapy. Other medical doctors of this time were exploring hypnotherapy, including Pierre Janet, a doctor who worked at the Pitié Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris. He developed a theory of disassociation, proposing that in hypnosis the conscious mind becomes suppressed, allowing the unconscious mind to surface. Around the same time of the late 1880s, Sigmund Freud became interested in studying hypnosis with Dr. Jean-Martin Charcot, who also worked at Pitié Salpêtrière. Dr. Charcot was studying with Dr. Ambroise Auguste Lebeau and Professor Hippolyte Bernheim. Freud was all but moved to tears the first time he sat in the audience of a medical hypnosis presentation. He wrote, quote, "With the idea of perfecting my hypnotic technique, I made a journey to Nancy in the summer of 1889 and spent several weeks there. I witnessed the moving spectacle of old Lebeau working among the poor women and children of the laboring classes. I was a spectator of Bernheim's astonishing experiments upon his hospital patients, and I received the proudest impression of the possibility that there could be powerful mental processes which nevertheless remained hidden from the consciousness of men," end quote. This resulted in Freud's using hypnosis as his inspiration for his regression technique known as the talking cure, which uncovered patients' suppressed memories. Stage act versus hypnotherapy. Medical demonstrations of hypnosis, such as the ones described in the story at the start of this chapter and by Freud, were commonplace in the 1800s. Eventually, these gave way to the use of hypnosis on a very different kind of stage. In my opinion, stage hypnosis has done as much to damage the image of hypnosis as the early church. While I understand how humorous these shows can be and that laughter is healing in and of itself, the view of hypnosis presented in these shows creates a false and distorted idea of how it works. It makes the volunteer look like a victim succumbing to the hypnotist's will, and that image couldn't be further from the truth. More important, it skews the positive benefits that hypnosis produces within a clinical environment. This section is probably going to upset a lot of my colleagues who are fabulous stage hypnotists and who always incorporate healing into their stage shows. A lot of stage hypnotists have great intentions, and if you just hired one for your next off-campus retreat, you're probably going to have a wonderful time, as many of them do genuinely care about helping their audiences. Still, I believe the following needs to be said. I love to laugh. When I want to relax or feel better, I often turn to YouTube and binge-watch Grace Helbig for way too long, or I embark upon the bliss of re-watching 30 Rock until it so cruelly and abruptly ends in the middle of the 7th season. The jokes of my favorite comedians don't hurt us. Sure, Grace Helbig, Kathleen Madigan, and Tina Fey may hit us in a place that causes us to squirm, but they don't hurt us in the sense that they don't distort a tool that heals bones faster, stops the leading cause of lung cancer and emphysema in its tracks, and sets people free from lifelong phobias. The church hasn't officially condemned hypnosis for about a century, so few people are avoiding it due to the sermon they heard last Sunday. It's because of stage hypnosis and how the tool is portrayed in the media. This is what has caused people to equate one of the most powerful tools for healing with clucking chickens. People who could have quit smoking years ago haven't because they believe hypnosis is mind control due to such movies as Now You See Me Too. They are told in such films as Office Space that when they go into a state of hypnosis, they will never come out. Shallow Hal attempted to teach us that hypnosis can make one see all overweight women as thin. And the most heinous and upsetting example to date, the movie Get Out, had me in tears inside the theater while I witnessed such a horrific and false presentation of hypnosis even as late as the year 2017. I honestly cannot believe there hasn't been a class action lawsuit yet to stop producers and screenwriters from the lazy and irresponsible use of hypnosis to explain why a character is behaving in a way they normally wouldn't. Imagine if every single time a chiropractor were depicted in a movie, they were seen crushing the bones of a patient. It would absolutely negatively impact the world's view of the entire field of chiropractics, and less people would be seeking out adjustments that could possibly bring them relief. Well, every single time hypnosis is depicted in a film or on a Vegas stage show, it is represented in a false, negative, and creepy way. And as a result, people who could have been free from the problems that plague them continue to suffer. Clearly, I'm sick of it. Often when I share this sentiment online, I receive some criticism telling me to relax, because I know it's just a movie. I know it's not real. And be that as it may, even if the viewer doesn't actually believe hypnosis does these things, and they realize this is all a device being amplified for the purpose of, quote, entertainment, it certainly doesn't give the impression that hypnosis can help them overcome their fear of speaking in public or that it will increase the likelihood of survival by 2 times for breast cancer patients. After someone watches Get Out, what is the likelihood that they will even bother to see whether the insomnia they've suffered for years could be cured in a matter of hours? Mainstream media has skewed the regular moviegoer's possibility of even considering such a positive potential outcome. I'm not claiming that hypnotherapy can help everyone on the planet with every issue 100% of the time. It isn't magic, and results vary, just as with most health and wellness treatments of any kind. But to negate the power of this tool altogether is just as harmful as dismissing the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, even if only a percentage of participants maintain sobriety. The people who don't relapse find true freedom. Not everyone who experiences an adjustment with a chiropractor or a session with an acupuncturist can claim it was life-changing, but there are those who have treatments like these regularly and swear by them. Essentially, like anything worthwhile, hypnosis works if you work it, and more people will work it if they're being told the truth about its potential use in their life versus the nonsensical display perpetuated by stage hypnotists in Hollywood. I was recently asked to hypnotize a reality TV star on a Kardashians-esque show. While speaking with the producer, he kept mentioning that he'd like to make the scene a little more visual. Could we expose the client to her phobia so that we could watch her freak out? Could I give her a cue after the session so that she would do something bizarre without realizing it? Could I make it so that she would forget the entire session, but all of a sudden be over the phobia and not know why? How could we make it more, quote, interesting for the audience, end quote, aka more dramatic and better for ratings? I had to explain to the producer that we were fundamentally at odds. His job is to make sure people watch the show because it's shocking. My job, as I see it, is a vendetta against all of the gimmicks that make hypnosis such a popular device in Hollywood movies. Although it's my mission to make hypnosis mainstream and media exposure is a great way to reach the masses, I had to turn the show down. Luckily, only a few months later, I was invited to help a woman overcome her sugar addiction on CBS's hit show, The Doctors. And that experience was a wonderful way to share with a massive audience just how natural, normal, and powerful hypnosis can be. I'm very grateful to The Doctors for portraying hypnosis in such a positive light. The fact of the matter is that clinical hypnosis is actually fairly boring to watch. There's nothing exceptionally visually interesting about it. That's because it's simply meditation with a goal. I understand the allure and convenience of using a tool and a script that allows the audience to think to itself, that character would never do that, but he was hypnotized, so I'm going to suspend my disbelief and continue to watch the movie without questioning the plot. However, perpetuating the ideas about hypnosis put forth in Hollywood and stage hypnosis actively hurts the audience, because it causes viewers not to consider a viable option that could drastically improve their lives. Once I saw Alexandre break through his paralysis, I came to find stage hypnosis upsetting and not remotely worth the laughs. Now that we're all clear on my opinion of stage hypnosis, let's discuss what stage hypnosis actually is. Stage hypnotists conduct a number of suggestibility tests to find out which people in the audience are a little bit suggestible, a good amount suggestible, or whether they are natural somnambulists. The hypnotists remember who those people are, so that when they ask for volunteers, they only bring to the stage those people who were at least moderately suggestible. The key point to remember here is that they asked for volunteers, people who already know they will be asked to do ridiculous things and are okay with this prospect in advance. Then, throughout the show, the hypnotist removes the people from the stage who are not accepting the suggestions, so that by the end of the show, all you're watching is someone of a high level of suggestibility who wants to comply with the suggestions he or she is being given. Now that you understand that people clucking like chickens are only doing it because they want to, let me step down from my rather large stage hypnosis soapbox and introduce you to one of the greatest hypnotherapists of all time. Contemporary practice. Milton Erickson, born 1901, died 1980, is a hero to many hypnotherapists. Although he is the father of modern-day hypnotherapy, Ericksonian hypnosis is, interestingly enough, known as being maternal in nature as compared to the paternal authoritarian hypnosis of the past. A domineering man screaming "sleep" at the top of his lungs gave way to Erickson's "You may notice you have already begun to relax." Erickson studied psychology and psychiatry, and he competently wrote about trance induction, experimental work exploring the possibilities and limits of the hypnotic experience, and investigations of the nature of the relationship between hypnotist and subject. The legitimacy of clinical hypnosis began to take root in the modern medical field with such figures as Erickson sharing positive data and leading the way with his cutting-edge techniques. Ericksonian technique includes a lot of storytelling, the use of archetypes, and supporting the client as they come to their own insights and conclusions. Rather than the hypnotist doing something to or for the client, in Ericksonian hypnosis, the client and hypnotherapist learn and discover together as the client heals him or herself. This is the kind of gentle, subtle, yet powerful hypnosis that's making its way into the mainstream. In 1958, the American Psychological Association established a certifying board of examiners in both clinical and experimental hypnosis. 10 years later, in 1968, the British Society of Medical and Dental Hypnosis was established. A few of today's key figures of contemporary hypnotherapy include superstar hypnotherapists Marie Mickey Mongan, the founder of hypnobirthing, Dr. Herbert Spiegel, Dr. David Spiegel, Wendy Friesen, Steve G. Jones, and Paul McKenna, who have reached millions with their studies, books, and recordings, and paved the way for many of us at a time when hypnotherapy was considered far more bizarre than it is now. Other contemporary hypnotherapists I've had the pleasure to work and study with personally include Paul Arand, Sophia Kramer, Dr. Vivian Keeler, Sarojini Alva, Changa Kadi, Randy Light, Martin Peterson, Dr. Shelley Stockwell Nicholas, and George Bien, to name a few. While each one of these hypnotherapists has a unique practice and may hold views that are very different from what I've discussed here, without them and dozens more, we wouldn't be in the position we are now to welcome hypnosis into the mainstream. I'm standing on the shoulders of hypnogiants, and I'm grateful. Speaking of gratitude, let's move on to this chapter's self-hypnosis process. Self-hypnosis process, infinite gratitude. You can find the written version of the script in the PDF that comes with your program. I suggest reading through the directions 2 or 3 times so that you will easily remember what to do once you close your eyes and get free. While listening to the audio version, you can just close your eyes, sit back, and relax as you follow along. However, please never listen to hypnosis while driving. If you're driving right now, please skip ahead to the next chapter and come back to follow along with this self-hypnosis process once you're in a safe place. Remember, video tutorials and audio recordings are available to you at www.closeyoureyesgetfree.com that will help you to become a self-hypnosis pro in no time at all. Begin by making note of your starting stress level. 10 equals a full-blown panic attack, and 0 equals 0 stress, no stress at all, the most relaxed a person can possibly be. Remember this number. Sit in a comfortable chair and place your feet on the ground, resting your hands gently in your lap. With your spine straight but comfortable and your eyes open, take 4 deep, slow breaths, inhaling through your nose for 4 counts and exhaling through your nose for 8 counts. Let's begin. In 2, 3, 4. Out 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. In 2, 3, 4. Out 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. In 2, 3, 4. Out 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. In 2, 3, 4. Out 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. With your eyes still closed, imagine gentle roots growing from the bottom of your feet all the way down into the center of the earth, grounding you. Bring all of your focus and awareness and attention to the palms of your hands. Perhaps you can feel your palms tingling. Perhaps you can feel your heartbeat in your hands. Perhaps you notice a sensation of expansion in your hands. Just notice and breathe for a few moments while I'm silent. Good. With your eyes still closed, follow along in your mind with me. 10. I am going deeper and deeper. 9. I am going deeper and deeper. 8. I am going deeper and deeper. 7. I am going deeper and deeper. 6. I am going deeper and deeper. 5. I am going deeper and deeper. 4. I am going deeper and deeper. 3. I am going deeper and deeper. 2. I am going deeper and deeper. 1. I am going deeper and deeper. For this next step, you're going to repeat affirmations in your mind or out loud after me, and you're going to fill in the blank. So for example, I will say, I'm grateful for, choose a person, and you will think in your mind or say out loud, I'm grateful for my mom, for example. Okay, let's begin. I am grateful for, choose a person. I am grateful for. Choose a place. I am grateful for. Choose a body part. I am grateful for. Choose a person. I am grateful for. Choose a place. I am grateful for. Choose a body part. I am grateful for. Choose a person. I am grateful for. Choose a place. I am grateful for. Choose a body part. Take another nice, deep, letting go breath and imagine experiencing immense gratitude for the rest of your day until you curl up into bed tonight. Allow that gratitude to magnify as you vividly imagine yourself hugging and high-fiving and laughing with all of the people, places, and things you're grateful for. Do this now while I'm silent. Good. Now that you've spent a few moments imagining the rest of your day filled with gratitude, put a gentle smile on your lips, open your eyes, stretch your arms over the top of your head, and say yes. Notice your new number on the scale. Remember, 0 equals 0 stress, the most relaxed you can be, and congratulate yourself on how quickly you improved your state. Here is a simple summary of the process. Notice starting stress level from 0 to 10. Take 4 deep, slow breaths. Grow roots. Notice your palms. Count down from 10 to 1, saying, I'm going deeper and deeper, after each number. Repeat the following hypno-affirmations 3 times each. I'm grateful for, fill in the blank with a person. I'm grateful for, fill in the blank with a place. I'm grateful for, fill in the blank with a body part. Imagine being filled with gratitude for the rest of the day. Smile while opening your eyes and say yes. Notice new number on the scale from 0 to 10. Congratulate yourself for improving your state so quickly. In this self-hypnosis script, we added one new step, which is to bring our focus and awareness and attention to the palm of our hands. Let's discuss why. Why do we bring our attention to the palm of our hands? This is a wonderful technique I learned from reading Eckhart Tolle's books. Bringing your focus and awareness and attention to the sensations in your palms is one of the fastest ways to return to the present moment. The present moment is the only time when lasting transformation can take place, as it is the only time that actually exists. And so this step helps bring us back from worrying about the past or obsessing about the future into the one moment where we can actually improve our life, right now. Next steps. Excellent. You have completed the Infinite Gratitude Self-Hypnosis process. Now go ahead and visit www.closeyoureyesgetfree.com to access this chapter's hypnosis recording. Pop in your headphones, sit back, relax, and close your eyes, get free. After you listen to the recording, please let me know how it went. Using the hashtag #closeyoureyesgetfree on Instagram or Twitter, message me at GraceSmithTV, your starting and ending numbers on the stress scale. By using the hashtag, you'll get to see how other listeners are improving right alongside you, plus I will have an opportunity to cheer you on. Move on to chapter 4 and look out for all of the wonderful benefits you're already starting to receive as a result of learning the power of hypnosis. Chapter 4, The Science of Hypnosis. Linda sat looking at her computer screen for a long time. Her heart was already racing. She had just received an email that contained the opportunity of a lifetime to present to the entire board of directors the project she had been overseeing for the past year. She knew her numbers, her projections had been conservative, and she was overperforming. Everything was on track, and she knew the board would be thrilled. They would absolutely roll her program out company-wide now that she had proven her strategy was such a success regionally. There was only one problem. She was now based out of the Chicago office, and this year the board's retreat would be held in their newest offices. Not New York, not Los Angeles, not in Miami, not even in London. Linda's mouth was already beginning to feel dry. It was difficult to swallow, and her hands were beginning to shake involuntarily. This year the board retreat would be held in Hong Kong. Ever since the tragedy of 9/11, Linda's fear of flying was debilitating. Whenever possible, she would drive to or even take trains to U.S.-based meetings. The few hellish times when she had to travel by plane to London, she knocked herself out with a Xanax and a few too many drinks. She would feel awful for at least 2 days between the hangover and the jet lag, yet she could muster the trip. Hong Kong, though? There was just no way. She would have to cancel, or worse yet, let someone unqualified take the credit for her career-defining project. Sure, they would say her name a half dozen times throughout the presentation, but the glory always goes to the one presenting. She snapped closed her laptop and grabbed her coat. She needed some fresh air. Once she was outside, the biting cold of Chicago's winter wind sliced right through her many layers. Her cheeks turned an immediate 3 shades brighter and her hands dug down deeper into her pockets. She had moved to Chicago in 2002 when she realized she just wasn't moving past that horrific day in New York, and it wasn't looking as if she ever would. Linda used to be based in the downtown New York City office, so close to the Twin Towers that she still couldn't walk on Wall Street without seeing it covered in a film of dust. She had lost so many friends, and her friends had lost so many friends. The pain was unbearable, and the memories just wouldn't fade. Prior to 2001, Linda still hadn't loved flying, but she didn't hate it. Her mother had always been pretty nervous on family vacations, taking deep breaths, tightening the seatbelt until she could barely breathe, watching the flight attendants like a hawk as they went through the motions of what to do during an emergency landing. Linda grew up watching her mother fly this way, and she just adopted some of the same habits and fears. But once they were in the air, she and her mother would calm down. It was really only during taxi, takeoff, and landing that they used to have a rough time. After 9/11, though, Linda was inconsolable. She already needed more than two hands to count the number of times she walked halfway down the, quote, gangplank, as she would call it, before turning around, running back up toward the airport to tell the agent at the desk still scanning tickets, "I just can't do it. Give mine to someone on standby." And forfeiting hundreds of dollars on a flight she would need to later rebook so as not to lose her job. She was already on thin ice. Linda had essentially been promoted as many times as someone could be promoted before her job required more travel. She had turned down 3 growth opportunities within the company, citing her PTSD, and her boss, although sympathetic, was also on edge. During the last quarterly review, in no uncertain terms, she had told Linda she couldn't continue to make more money for doing the same job forever, even though her expertise and deliverables were more and more impressive. Essentially, Linda would either need to learn to be okay with regular international travel, or she would need to move on to another job. This trip to Hong Kong felt like a test. It would catapult her to new levels within the company, or it would be the kiss of death. Linda ducked inside a Starbucks to get out of the cold and called her best friend. Over a piping hot latte, she filled Michaela in, finishing with, "I guess this is it. I'll have to start all over. No one will hire me at the same level unless I'm okay to travel. From here on out, I either need to start over or be okay with going backward." Michaela replied, "The thing I always find so amazing is that it terrifies you to get to the meetings, but once you're there, you shine. You love public speaking. Whereas I always get so nervous speaking in front of anyone, whether it's 10 people I know or 100 strangers, I'm equally shaking like a leaf. You know, my HR department is now offering this group hypnotherapy class once a week to overcome fear of public speaking. I haven't tried it yet, but a few colleagues are already swearing by it. I wonder if the same hypnotherapist could help you with your fear of flying." Linda was at her wit's end and was willing to try anything. Michaela quickly looked at the contact information for the hypnotherapist inside her company's directory, and within 30 minutes, Linda had booked her first appointment. A week later, Linda and Michaela met for dinner. So how did it go with the hypnotherapy? Are you cured? Michaela asked. Well, I don't know about cured just yet, Linda said with a smile, but it was really interesting, actually. The hypnotherapist said that while many fears or phobias can be almost entirely irrational, which makes them even easier to overcome, the fear of flying is at least partially legitimate. Even though it's technically much safer to fly than it is to drive in terms of the likelihood of ending up in an accident, of course, not all car accidents are fatal, and with plane crashes, well, you get the point. So basically, I had to thank my subconscious for trying to keep me safe, to let it know that I appreciated its concern, but that ultimately the fear of flying was hurting me a lot more than flying itself ever had. We had to focus on tangible data in my life, essentially that the fear of flying has caused real, true damage in my life, whereas with flying itself, I have always arrived perfectly safe and sound wherever I was going. This logic, while in hypnosis, seemed to create some kind of shift, and I really felt it. We then visualized my easily staying calm on the plane, and the hypnotherapist made me a recording I can listen to during takeoff and landing. I mean, I guess I won't know if it really worked until the next time I'm boarding a plane, but I have to say, when I think about flying, I'm not having the same racing heart or shaking hands or terrible thoughts. I just feel slightly apprehensive, as I used to when I was younger. I'm going back for a follow-up session next week, and the flight to Hong Kong is a week after that, so I'll have a few more days to decide whether my career is going to sink or swim. Michaela lifted her glass and clinked Linda's. Here's hoping hypnosis works. A year later, Michaela and Linda met up at their favorite nail salon for a pedicure. As soon as they settled down in their comfy chairs and the treatment began, Michaela reached down and pulled a little present out of her purse. She handed the bright little package to Linda, saying, "Congratulations to the most fabulous global manager I've ever laid eyes on. I'm so proud of you." This story is derived from a real client I had who was truly on the brink of losing her job, only to turn her fear of flying around so thoroughly that within a year she was promoted to global manager. The power of the mind is truly astounding. Did you know that Thomas Edison and Albert Einstein used hypnosis? There are actually many innovators, creative visionaries, and top athletes who use hypnosis to access the theta brainwave state to enhance their performance. James Earl Jones, the voice of Darth Vader, used hypnosis to overcome stuttering. Tiger Woods has used it to improve his golf game. The late Princess Diana used it to overcome her fear of public speaking. Ben Affleck and too many other celebrities to list used it to quit smoking. And many Olympic athletes use it to prepare for competition. Thomas Edison is well known for his quote-unquote naps, which were actually a deeply relaxed state between waking consciousness and sleep, where creativity flowed like a child's. In this state, he was delightfully uninhibited and unencumbered by self-criticism. Edison would put himself into a hypnotic state while holding a metal ball in his hand. If he relaxed deeper than he had intended, moving from theta to delta, sleep, the metal ball would drop into a metal pan beneath his hand, waking him so that he could start again. Accessing this state allowed him to problem solve on a subconscious level where aha moments necessary for breakthroughs often occur. Scientific and clinical studies at the Mayo Clinic, Yale University, and Stanford University continue to shed scientific light on the efficacy of hypnosis. And in preparation for this book, I was lucky enough to work with Dr. Kirthi Sunder and Samantha Franklin of Mind and Body Treatment and Research Institute in Southern California on our own study. You'll find more info about our study in just a little while, but let me take a few moments to introduce Dr. Sunder and Samantha, as I will be referencing their insights quite a bit throughout this chapter. We met at a conference in Denver, Colorado, and instantly, Dr. Sunder, Samantha, and I knew we had shared missions and interests. We stayed in touch, and a few months later, my husband and I had the pleasure of visiting Dr. Sunder and Samantha at their institute in California. We had planned for a 2-hour visit, but ended up staying for 14 hours. We learned all about the fascinating use of neurofeedback and TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, which are offered at the institute. And I was thrilled to answer all of their questions as they were deeply interested in hypnotherapy and how it could be used as an adjunct tool to help their patients. We then decided to conduct an informal study specifically for this audiobook to measure outcomes of 1 week of hypnotherapy, and you can find the entire study inside the appendix, which is in the PDF that came with this program. 1 week may seem like a short time, but even one session of hypnosis has often proved to be extraordinarily life-altering. So while short and sweet, the information garnered from this study is as telling as it is fascinating. Kirthi Sunder, the medical director and founder of Mind and Body Treatment and Research Institute, has more than 20 years of experience as a medical doctor and holds diplomas from the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, American Board of Addiction Medicine, and the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, London. His membership list in the field of mental health and addiction is extensive and includes a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. He also serves as a board member of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, San Jacinto, and an editorial board member for the Journal of Addiction Therapy and Research, to name a few. He is a Dream Builder member of the Academy of Integrative Health and Medicine, a member of the Credentialing Committee for the American Board of Addiction Medicine, and an accredited menopause practitioner. He speaks internationally, has had numerous professional articles published, and is the author of the best-selling Addictions, Face Your Addiction and Save Your Life. His passion is to integrate the mind, body, and soul in medicine. In addition to all of this, he is an incredibly kind, welcoming, and genuine man. Samantha Franklin is a neuromodulation technologist who is also the practice director for the Mind and Body Treatment and Research Institute. Her background is in biomedical study at the University of California, Riverside, and she is a strong proponent of therapeutic modalities such as hypnosis, mindfulness meditation, neurofeedback, and TMS. Samantha is also a world-class musician who played stand-in bass for albums recorded at Abbey Road Studios in London. Whereas my all-girl rock band from yesteryear came to an end after a few short months, Samantha's played the Warped Tour. We're two ladies who are equally as passionate about making the world a better place through accessing the subconscious mind as we are about music. It was the bedrock for endless geeking out. In short, working with Dr. Sunder and Samantha Franklin has been a dream come true. Often it's difficult to ascertain the true impact of hypnotherapy because there are so many variables, as every hypnotherapist uses different words and a different approach in his or her practice, and each has different levels of rapport with clients. Furthermore, all clients come to the session with different expectations, which can significantly impact how they might respond to various suggestions. With that in mind, I set out to conduct my own study for the purposes of this book, and I was lucky enough to have the immense support and knowledge of Dr. Sunder and Samantha. Although the power of hypnosis has been evidenced in client testimonials and in the fact that the world's elite have been using this tool for centuries, the science behind it is now finally catching up. Let's review some of what we now know about this tool, which has been mired in mystery and misunderstanding for far too long, beginning with the findings of our study. Our study, the power of hypnosis. Over 100 people started the study, and 35 completed it from beginning to end. We used only data from those who completed the study. This shows us that the first hurdle to overcome is showing up for our daily commitments. Hypnosis only works if we actually do it. To help with this, I've created a hypnosis recording to help increase your desire and commitment to actually complete your hypnosis every day. You can find it at www.closeyoureyesgetfree.com. For more information, see the PDF that came along with this program. The study included listening to the same hypnosis recording once per day for 7 days in a row and completing a quiz before and after. We measured 21 positive emotions and 40 negative ones, as well as overall stress levels. We chose these emotions based on words commonly used during therapy sessions and on intake forms. For the full list, see the PDF that came along with your program. The answers were randomized so that every time the quiz was taken, the answers were in a different order. The biggest increases showed that on average, participants were 32% happier, 29% more content, and 27% more satisfied after 7 days of listening to the hypnosis recording. Decreases in emotion were even more significant, which is interesting. This suggests that it is faster to let go of a habit than to create one. At the same time, participants felt on average 80% less disdain, 80% less furious and disgusted, 58.8% less depressed, and 54.5% less angry, and the feeling of procrastination decreased by 51.5%. In addition, although stress levels decreased dramatically immediately following the recording, stress levels were still lower than ever by the end of the week. How much did overall stress levels decrease? By 45.5%. How would you like to be 45.5% less stressed out, 32% happier, and 51.5% less likely to procrastinate in just 7 days? Amazing, isn't it? For a greater in-depth understanding of our study, please turn to the PDF that came with this program. Now that we've reviewed the basic findings of our study, let's dive deeper into the science behind how and why hypnosis works. I asked Dr. Sunder and Samantha to provide us with some answers to help us further understand how hypnosis works within the framework of our complicated mind. Question: what is the mind? Answer: the mind is the home for consciousness. It represents the software that allows for the manifestation of thought, memory, and imagination. Question: what is the subconscious mind? Answer: it is the part of the mind that we cannot access readily but stores our emotions, feelings, and memories. It's also the receptacle for our imagination, intuition, and spiritual experiences. Question: what is the brain? Answer: the brain is the physical home where the mind resides. Question: what are brain waves? Answer: brain waves are the building blocks of our consciousness. They facilitate a complex system of communication and operate like a symphony orchestrated by the brain cells or neurons. Question: how do we measure brainwaves? Answer: delicate sensors are applied to the surface of the scalp that capture the electrical activity of the brainwaves. The four brainwaves of delta, theta, alpha, and beta are characterized by unique bandwidth frequencies and reflect states of consciousness ranging from alertness to deep sleep. Question: what is the mind-body connection? Answer: states of dysregulation have their origins in the disruption of mind-body barriers. The psyche, the human soul, mind, or spirit, and the soma, the body as distinct from the soul, mind, or psyche, are inextricably connected. Question: what are neurons? Answer: neurons are the foundational building blocks of the nervous system. They are the conduits of electrical and chemical communication. Question: what does it mean when we say neurons that fire together wire together? Answer: the brain is an adaptive and plastic organ. When we pay attention to happy thoughts and experiences, the nerve cells fire and wire in the direction of promoting blissful states. The opposite is also true. When we repeatedly pay attention to sad thoughts and feelings, the nerve cells fire and hardwire negative patterns. This phenomenon is also referred to as neuroplasticity. Question: what is the reptilian brain? Answer: it's the oldest part of the evolutionary brain that is responsive to our primal desire to survive by flight or fight. It's an unregulated response expressed by the part of the brain also called the limbic brain. Question: without having formally studied hypnotherapy, but knowing all you do about how the brain functions, what are your thoughts on how hypnotherapy works? Answer: hypnosis is a process that produces increased awareness of the unconscious mind, heightened sense of suggestibility, and deep relaxation to access the subconscious mind without resistance. This allows for brain wave state shifts to take place to promote wellness and recovery. Question: in the same way, without having formally studied hypnotherapy, what are your thoughts on why hypnotherapy is so effective? Answer: hypnotherapy does not access willpower, but has the amazing ability to utilize the power of imagination and affect a change in reality by accessing the subconscious mind. Question: what is neurofeedback? Answer: neurofeedback is a non-invasive, non-pharmaceutical brain exercise. We show your brain a reflection of its own activity while you sit back and enjoy a movie or a video game driven by your own brainwaves. This allows your brain to